Lauren, I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank you all for having me here tonight, especially Sam, who gave me a text and a phone call and a reminder one, which is always helpful for me. I try to write everything down, but reminders help. It's just great to be up here tonight. I see a lot of familiar faces and some good longtime friends in the crowd who've heard me speak numerous times, so they are kind and gracious to be here again tonight. So thank you. So I'm hopefully tonight what I'm going to do exactly what, you know, Billy just read in a general way, share my experience with, you know, how I got sober and how I developed and maintained a relationship with the God of my understanding. And I'm going to start from the beginning. Before I do, I'll just give you a few, you know, it's like the highlights. My sobriety date is May 23rd of 2000. I have a home group for the basic text big book study. We meet at 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings in Ashland. So if you ever like to get in your car and drive for a couple hours super early in the morning, please come visit us. Or if you're hanging out in Ashland for some other reason, we love people to come and visit us. It's we're just outside of Richmond, so while we do get some visitors, it's you know, it's a lot of the same people, so which is great for building community. Let's see, I think I said I have a sponsor, and I have the privilege of sponsoring some other ladies in the program. And I'm just grateful, you know. Today has been an interesting day for me, and I've had the opportunity to be connected in a lot of different ways with people pursuing a spiritual path and conversations and listening and phone calls. And that stuff just always reminds me of, I'm just grateful. I'm grateful. I wouldn't have any of this if I wasn't sober. And for me, sobriety has been the beginning of the journey of deepening and growing in my relationship with God and learning how to have relationships with people. Because I don't know about you guys, but relationships with people can be exciting and fun and challenging. And, you know, sometimes I'm just like, I don't know, you know. And I get to be human through all of that and experience just what that looks like. So, I mean, I'll talk about that in my story, but before Alcoholics Anonymous, my desire was to not have much of a relationship with people. I kind of like to be a lone wolf. I like to do my own thing because I want to do what I want to do, and I don't want you interfering with that. And I want to drink the way I want to drink, and I want to, you know, whatever. I want to steal something from a store. If I want to steal from it, I want to do what makes sense to me. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been kind of the reverse of that. And learning how to do that did not come naturally for me. You know, we have our circle and triangle with recovery, unity, and service. And unity is a real big piece of that. I mean, it's one of the pieces of the triangle. It's huge. And I just did not come naturally to that. I mean, it was years and years and years of me taking actions that put me in contact with people, that placed me amongst folks on a similar path, and a continual surrender to, you know, it's okay. Just because I feel uncomfortable is not going to kill me. Just because I'm not sure if they really want me here or not is not going to kill me. And then, having that just kind of explode and follow me and change. I mean, there are things, there's stuff that's happened to me because of the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't even, stuff goes on that I don't even know about, you know, of how people are praying for you or helping you or doing things. And it's like, for someone who doesn't like any of that stuff, it's all been a brand new experience. And that's also just fed outward into my family, into how I relate when I'm a stay-at-home mom right now. So that presents its own unity challenges. But before that, into the workplace. And, so it's just been a really interesting journey. And sometimes I take it for granted that all I've been given because of being connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. So my story is also one of irony, I think. I grew up in Ashland, which is where I now live. I live next door to my parents, who are people they are great, really awesome parents, but, you know, from, I don't know, 10 on, I was trying to get out of that small town, away from seeing the same people in the grocery store and at church and around the corner and at school and in my home. I just didn't like that. I didn't like small townness. I didn't like people knowing what was going on with me. I didn't like not being able to do what I wanted to do without consequences. And here I am. I live next door to my parents in my grandparents' farmhouse, and I am a part of that community. And, you know, it's really cool to see people in the grocery store, and it's really cool to have an opportunity to have people in my home to start to, because of how I lived for so long, I really cut off a lot of those ties to people who saw me grow up and saw me kind of like go off the cliff with active alcoholism. And probably over the last, you know, I mean, certainly the last 10 years, but especially in the last year, I've really gotten connected with some of those people in a different way and been able to, like, give back in ways that has really been surprising to me. And one of those is that I started visiting the church that I grew up in. And so, I mean, there are people in their 70s and 80s and 60s and 50s that saw me grow up. And they're at different places in their life now where, as an adult, I can come alongside and just talk to them in the hallway or help out at their 50th wedding anniversary celebration or serve their kids in a new way. And I'm somebody who I burn things down and then I leave. And so I've been given, it's just another layer of being able to show up and participate in a really different way. And so I just think that's neat. And it, literally, I'm always surprised. I'm like, whoa, God, who knew? Plan C. Because I have this narrow way of thinking so much of the time. So I grew up in this small town. I was, I was a goody two-shoes, sort of, you know. I'm kind of sarcastic and I like to push buttons a lot, but I grew up in a church, and my grandfather was the minister of another local church, and I went to school, and I kind of did my thing, and I struggled with kind of the unity piece, I guess, to put it in AA's terms. I had a lot of people who knew me on a general level, and I had very few people who really knew, like, the inside of me. I had trouble fitting in. I'm a perpetual, I go to a basketball camp for a week. Well, I don't like that. Or I try a running team for, I don't like that. Or I try to be smart. Well, I'm not as smart as those people, so I should quit that. A lot of my life has been characterized by that. I'm pretty lazy. I used to think that if you were going to do something, that you were like, instantaneously good at it the first or second time you tried it. And what I understand today is I'm sure there are, you know, rock stars that throw in pots on the pottery wheel, but most artists I know spend years perfecting their trade and their skill. And, it's only been in sobriety that I've even been willing to take a look at that and to begin to practice that. So my approach to life has been, it was pretty surfacey. You know, and I started to just be dissatisfied. My parents weren't cool enough. The church I went to was definitely not cool enough. I didn't like being just all eyes were on me. I was an only child. I was an only grandchild, small town. And so because of the nature of this, like where I live, because it's kind of a little bit out in the middle of nowhere, we go to school with people probably to a 30 to 40 mile radius, or minute maybe not mile. And so I started to get connected in high school with kids who lived outside my hometown. They lived in another little small community, which I loved, because when you go there, nobody knows you. You don't run into people in the, you know, convenience store that know your whole life history, and if you happen to be doing something you shouldn't be doing, you're going to report back to your grandfather or your grandmother or your mom or dad or, you know. And, so I got excited about that, and I got excited about kids that were doing stuff that looked more fun than what I was doing. So I started to slowly walk away from things like an active church life, an active youth group life, and started to pursue other things, like people that were partying and hanging out. And I'm very strategic about this because I don't want to be caught. I don't want to answer any questions. I don't want to be inconvenienced by you. And so I started hanging out and doing what I wanted to do on the weekends. And eventually that led to my junior prom. I'm kind of a late bloomer when it comes to drinking. And I went with this straight-edge skateboard guy to prom. If you guys know what that means, you don't drink or do drugs. And he was really just my ticket to prom. And then we were going to the after party where I was finally going to, like, live the life. I was going to hang out with the cool people. I was going to drink. I was going to do, you know, whatever the night, you know. I had fantasies about, you know, what the night could entail. And up to this point, my experience with alcohol had been very minor. You know, my friend and I used to sip off the box of wine with a little bit of orange juice when we were younger. And I didn't have any effect. I probably didn't drink enough alcohol to get an effect produced by that. We thought we were pretty cool, but it didn't really manifest itself in anything. But that night it did. And for me, it was probably the closest thing as to what I'm trying to achieve here, which is being present, being awakened, being comfortable in my own skin. And I didn't, of course, know that was what was going on. But I started drinking these little frou-frou daiquiri drinks and mixed drinks and just, I mean, it was wonderful. I felt so good and warm. And, you know, the cool guy that was hosting the party, he came up and sat in my lap and kissed me. And I thought, I mean, I have arrived. I'm home at last. You know, I'm with my people. I'm having a good time. This hottie guy obviously wants to be my boyfriend. Because, you know, he's sitting on my lap kissing me. That wasn't what he was signing up for. But I take hostages. So. And, you know, the night unfolded, you know. And my best friend that I used to drink, you know, the box of wine and orange juice with, she was there that night. And, you know, again, she's having a good time. And that was her ex-boyfriend, and I didn't think there was any problem with that. And she informed me later there was, and I didn't get it, and I didn't want to get it. I didn't want to understand how the way I interact with other people might affect you, might hurt your feelings, might be inappropriate. I just was like, basically, get over it. You know, you guys dated a month. He likes me now. Like, I'm going after this. And that's one of the things I loved about alcohol and all the other things I pursued. They kind of gave me the nerve, or for lack of a better word, I guess, to just go and pursue and do whatever I wanted to do. I wanted to be free. I wanted to be free of what you thought of me. I wanted to go after what I wanted. And so from that night on, you know, I'm not the person who started drinking before school or started cutting class or any of that, because I have an image to maintain. And again, I didn't even know I was doing this, but I just started living that double life where I'm the good girl who goes to school and gets pretty decent grades during the week, and I go to church. And then, you know, Friday and Saturday night, I'm partying with my friends. I don't know that I've ever been a social drinker. I've always enjoyed drinking for effect. I like to drink as much as I can, as fast as I can, and I like to feel, for me, it's freedom. My dad talks about drinking a couple drinks and feeling out of control, and he doesn't like that. I don't understand that. Like, I feel more in control when I put alcohol in my body. I'm also a big blackout drinker. Those didn't show up so much early on, but as I started to pursue alcohol more and more and more, they started to show up a lot more. So I did that, you know, let's see, all that summer, my senior year of high school, and I graduated when I was 17 and went off to Virginia Tech because my parents had saved money for me to go to school, which I am a spoiled brat and had no clue that other people had different paths. So I just took advantage of that and I rolled with it. And I didn't even know, like, it's so clueless. You know, when you look back, it's like what you take advantage of and what you take for granted. And as I stay sober, I see more and more about what it looks like. You know, I mean, what advantages I was given and sacrifices that were made so that I could have something different than they had, because they didn't grow up like that. There was no college paved way for them. There was no not having to work. None of that stuff. And so I went with the intention of being a good girl Monday through Friday. I was a pre-med student. I wanted to be, I saw those commercials on TV about children over in Ethiopia, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go and be in another country helping disadvantaged children. I'm a rooter for the underdog. I always have been. And I just was, felt really passionate about it for about a semester. And 8 o'clock classes, and Thursday night, you know, happy hour, and Wednesday night, and then Tuesday night, and the occasional Monday night. Didn't work well with trying to be pre-med. It didn't work well with trying to be a horticulture major, or an environmental major, or an English major, or an education major, or all of the other wonderful tracks I tried. I mean, I tried all kinds of things. I would take nutrition classes because I kept, again, I had this idea that if I find my right place, that it's just going to be easy, you know? Like, life's kind of hard, I feel like. And I live most of my life in my head, so that's what makes it so hard. But, you know, without the parameters of coming home to mommy and daddy every night, my alcoholism just took off in a real big way. I started to slowly, and you know, the funny thing was, as I used to say, it happened then, but the truth was, is it started long before that. I mean, in high school, the people who didn't drink on the weekend, I didn't hang out with them anymore at all. And the people I was kind of still hanging out with that kind of drank a little bit when we went to college, if they didn't drink, like, my drinking progressed and progressed and progressed. If it didn't take that same path, then I didn't hang out with them either. So I started to get a whole new set of people, a whole new what was acceptable and what was unacceptable. And I spent the next 3 years up there just whittling away at any type of things that make sense. You know, any morals that I was given growing up. I used to say, you know, I didn't have any problem breaking if it was your idea of what my life should look like or your moral value that you had imposed upon me. I didn't have any problem breaking that. But what started to happen to me is I started to live inconsistent with even the little morals that I had. And I was doing things that I didn't want to be doing. I was waking up places with people that I had no intention of being there. Again, I'm a big blackout drinker. I'm a big bedwetter, so that was kind of always iffy if I spent the night with you, whether you're going to have a dry bed in the morning. Of course, they didn't know that going in. I started to see a psychiatrist. I thought, this just kind of that life was hard, and I guess some people would call it depression. I had had some of that in high school. But it was alleviated a lot through drinking, and it started to come back. And I thought it was due to, you know, this guy I was dating, that he was probably cheating on me and all this stuff. And so I started to seek out other stuff to help me, in addition to continually changing my degree and what I'm doing, and I'm going to try running, and I'm going to go to the gym, and I'm going to date a different type of guy, or I'm going to quit smoking, or it's this combination of substances that landed me in this place. I started seeking out, you know, psychiatric and then a therapist, and that, I mean, well-meaning people, you know, we had a lot of really great conversations, but my drinking did not change as a result of that. And so my next great plan was that I'm just going to drop out of school and I'm going to wait tables. I've waited tables since I was 14. So I like it. It's social. You talk some smack. You make some money. You know, it's a good time. So I did that for and stayed up there about another year. And I started to just hanging out with some people that I was ashamed to be seen in public with. And embarrassed. Like, they were known as, like, the town drunks, the people who peed on themselves and went out in public, who stunk, who didn't bathe, who started drinking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we all got off our shift. And so instead of like doing something different, I just left because that's what I do. And I went home and I lived with my mom and dad for a little while, and I tried to get a different type of job and just provide some structure because I was like, that's what I need. Different people, structure. I'm going to change. I'm going to be, you know, something's got to give here. And it was basically, you know, a couple weeks and the same thing. You know, I'm hanging out with people. I'm staying up till 4 a.m. I'm blacking out. Now I'm driving around, instead of the Blacksburg countryside, I'm now driving around downtown Richmond in blackouts. And, I don't think I'm any more, I don't think the mercy of God is shown any more on me than someone who did get a DUI or who did run into a car or who did kill someone on the sidewalk. That stuff didn't happen to me, but I don't think I'm any different than them. I mean, I don't know why. I can't explain why that didn't happen, but I certainly created the opportunity for that a lot. And I met this guy because I soon had to quit my job because that became very inconvenient for the way I wanted to live. And so I found these people who weren't working. They were on they worked construction jobs, and they were taking kind of a lead from their construction job. So we all just drank and did all kinds of stuff around the clock, and it was the type of place that not many people who were there paid rent or lived there. We all just kind of squatted there, and I mean, glass would be broken on the days for floor for days. I mean, people just didn't care. We didn't eat very much. We might scrape together some change and go get some spaghetti and a jar of ragu or something and make a meal every once in a while, but it wasn't a high priority. And I met this guy there that was a roommate, so I upgraded myself to the bedroom shortly thereafter, and then we took off on a tour with Widespread Panic, this band who he adored and I didn't know much about. It's not that I didn't enjoy their music, I just wasn't a Panic head, but I am a huge fan of going on tour with bands and the pre-party festival that goes on for days on end. I mean, I love that. And I fit really well into, it's kind of like this street grunge hippie lifestyle. I really like that. We're going to go live on, a hippie commune, or we're going to live out of our car in the middle of a city, or we're going to change our names and live underground. Society, like all that stuff is very attractive to me. It is still a noticeable spiritual principle for me to do things like pay my bills and participate in U.S. government tax system and all that stuff. I just like to buck the system. But I don't do it today, which is great. So I'm hanging out with him, and, our business arrangement of going on tour, and, we were selling glassware and chips and cigarettes and bottled water and all that stuff. It obviously wasn't going anywhere because he's not an alcoholic. He's not even a drug addict, I don't think. And we did a lot of that stuff, but he has like one Corona and he's done. And meanwhile, I'm like disappearing in these new places we're going because I found usually a group of men at a bar who want to buy me drinks. And that's exactly who I'm looking for. And he has to come find me and, in his opinion, rescue me from the impending danger that I put myself in. I thought he was like a killjoy and a wet blanket, and he was interfering with me and my budding new relationship that was about to happen. And he would drag me back to the car, and I had a lab with a dog that would travel around with us, and but it was just kind of crazy. We lived out of his car and would, camp out or go stay at people's places, and it was a lot of fun for me. But at the same time, if I slowed down at all, I started to get that little bit of, restlessness. Like, does this make sense? I don't even really like him. But, yeah, I'm participating in things with him that you wouldn't do with someone that you don't really like. Does he even like me? I'm not quite sure. But he was tired of me, I can tell you that. Living with an active alcoholic when you're not one is exhausting, and it starts to, that's what they talk about in our literature, it's a family illness. it starts to erode and this insidious nature of all this just really just sickness pervades whoever it touches. And that's what I was. I was like a sickness who pervaded whoever I touched. And lucky for him and me too, I found my soulmate at the end of that show, this guy named Star, and he really was part of an underground movement, and I loved that. And he had I renamed myself Indigo. I didn't get a whole lot of time to practice that name. And he had a beautiful 3-year-old son whose mommy was in rehab down in Florida. And I wasn't trying to be his mommy, but, you know, in a way I was. 3-year-olds are a lot of fun. We would color on ourselves with markers and run around these festivals. And I got a glimpse of what it might look like to have someone to be responsible for other than me. And what that would look like is we would get up at, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning. And I had this great idea one day that we should walk around and find bottle caps. I'm not sure why. It was probably the only thing to do. And I would start drinking and doing other things. And then I wouldn't think about him again until maybe 11 o'clock that night. And I wouldn't know where he was or what had happened to him or who was taking care of him or who had put him to bed. And that was a real rub on me. I don't think I really took a hard look at that, but that was uncomfortable to see that, like, where I want to go and what I want to do means that I can't have anything tagging along on that. And this is also when I started to have what has been diagnosed many different things. I had a therapist call it a nervous breakdown. I had my friend thinks I got dosed with peyote. I don't know what happened to me. I had well-meaning psychiatrists and Tuckers diagnose me as bipolar 2 disorder and a slew of other mental illnesses. But I took their everything has meaning and this kind of spiritual underground. Like an example would be like we stop at the 420 exits in a pinch. We can put water in our gas tank and it'll go because we're tapped in to this God that where you can go drink and do drugs as much as you want and that's okay. And you kind of can run under the radar screen as long as you, you know, are reading the clues. And for someone with a mind like mine, man, you tell me I got to get it together, I got to pay attention, I got to figure it out, and I am in overdrive. Because he tells me he's a prophet, and I believe him, and I really want to be a prophet's girlfriend and eventually a prophet's wife. But somehow that's going to elevate me, I'm sure, or at least have special privileges. And he's talking about going in, again, you know, it's like this fantasy land of living on a hippie commune and, you know, homeschooling this little 3-year-old and raising our own vegetables and just drinking during the week and doing the harder stuff on the weekends so we can be so responsible. And, you know, I mean, this is just, I mean, this may not sound attractive to most people, but for me, I'm like, this is awesome. Like, I am loving this, coming from a small town, conservative, expectation-oriented family. Like, this is just total freedom. I just get to go and be and feel and, you know. I was really excited about it. And everyone I met was just this really free-spirited, open love, you know. But I couldn't get it together. And I started not sleeping, and I wasn't eating. And I had shaved my head. I had a little buzz cut. In Asheville, we did it because that seemed like a good idea. I also had, like, many piercings at this time because I'm really into, like, if you don't like me the way I am, then you should probably just, you know, back off. Because I don't like people that go to work 9-to-5. I don't like people that pay their taxes. You've all sold out to the government and everything else. So anything, like, you know, a little subversive, I was very interested in. And so I'm with him, less than 2 weeks. I don't even know. And I get, it may have been like 8 days. I don't even know. And he's had enough of me. I lost his dog because in my free-spiritedness, I let our dogs out. And he has a beagle. So beagles go and explore and find things in the woods and never come back. And that's what he did. And I got the cops called on us twice for people that want to run under the radar. That was pretty inconvenient. And I'm doing and saying crazy things. And he leaves me with some friends at an apartment complex and drives to Philadelphia, and he says he's coming back and that I should figure it out and get it together. And so while he's gone, I'm working really, really hard to figure it out and following the signs, and end up in someone else's apartment and get a felony breaking and entering charge and get hauled off once again. You know, not once again. This is the cops came this time, and this time they took me somewhere versus all the other times they had come. And it was, you know, it was the end of the world, I thought. And I'm going to the safe place, and this is like Star Wars. And the Bible verses written on the mattress mean something. And so I asked for a Bible so that I can decipher them to see when he's going to come pick me up. And my dad calls me one day, and he says, "You do realize that you're in jail, don't you?" And I said, "Oh, yes, of course I did." But he didn't, you know, so I spent the next time just trying to figure that out, you know, which involves crying and, you know, throwing a temper tantrum in jail and shoving all my belongings out of the cell door, like everything, my toilet paper, my soap, my clothes, my nice wool blanket, my sheets, my mattress. I even managed to shove that under the door because I'm not getting my way. You're not letting me out. You know, STAR's not coming to save me. And so I just go ballistic. And I didn't even know I was already on suicide watch and solitary confinement and all this stuff. And you do get some attention when you act like that. But in jail, they don't give you your sheets back or your toilet paper or your soap or your toothbrush or any of that. They gave me, first it was a cloth napkin that quickly dissolved. And then it was a nice mattress and wool blanket. And I stayed like that until, I don't know, honestly. All this is kind of a blur. But my parents came and bailed me out. There was a $20,000 cash bail on me because they thought I was a flight risk. Little did they know, STAR did not want to have anything to do with me. But they didn't know that. But I didn't meet the criteria of the people that I was traveling with. So they thought something was wrong with me. And I learned years later that there were, it's like, I don't know if you guys have had this experience, I'm sure you have, that like people are intervening that you don't even know about, you know, trying to help you because something's terribly wrong with you and everyone can see it but you. Because someone who goes from, you know, aspirations of being a doctor in Africa now wants to live out of her car and has a shaved head and a black eye, and I'm probably at least 30 pounds less than what I weigh right now. I look like I come out of a concentration camp. And so that is the beginning of a journey for me where a lot of what I hold very dear, like my freedom and my ability to reason and manipulate and get what I want and work the system and meet a new man and get to a new place and get a job for a couple of weeks so I can get $50 so I can get out of town, are taken from me because, well, I took them from me. I don't think anybody else did. And it brought me to this really great place of just desperation. And multiple diagnoses and many hoops to jump through for the court system and the doctors. And, you know, I failed most of those hoops. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, which I was not interested in at all. I called myself an alcoholic for a day because it seemed like maybe a good idea. And I identified somewhat with what you were talking about. But I really didn't think, because I'm 22, you know, I'm too young. I don't drink every day, and I do not drink out of a brown paper bag, so therefore I am not alcoholic. And I didn't, you know, like I said, I got introduced in Tucker's to a couple AA meetings, but I didn't pursue that. I tried to pursue STAR. He wouldn't have anything to do with me. And I eventually landed with this therapist who said one of the greatest things that's ever been said to me, "I don't know what's wrong with you." Oh, I have an idea, you know. I can tell you one thing, if you don't quit drinking and doing drugs for at least a year, your body is not going to recover from what I think has happened to you. And I said, okay, I can do that, sure. Because there's something about him that broke through all the noise, you know. Today I look at that as like there's just like this teeny bit of crack and the sunlight of God starts to shine through and it just shined through him. And I at this point, I cannot drive a car. Because I start adding up license plates and following them to where I'm supposed to be. And my mommy, at the age of 22, drives me to this therapist's office 3 times a week. I'm unemployable. I am majorly depressed because I'm not drinking. Drinking, when I do it, speeds me up instead of slows me down. Makes me real manic. I don't sleep. I'm in like total overdrive. I am, you know, reading things and adding things and figuring things out and going crazy. And so I start this journey with him where I try not to drink. And I'm able to put some time together. That's another belief that I held on to that made me non-alcoholic, was that I could put 3 months together and not drink. But then I would have a blowout. I would have an intention of having a glass of wine with a friend at dinner because I've been, like, holed up at my parents' house for 3 months with my dog, and I haven't seen anybody, and I don't do anything. And so it makes sense, right? I should go out to dinner with my friend, and a glass of wine makes sense because that's what people do. They have a glass of wine with dinner. But see, my glass of wine turns into, before the waitress can even move, a bottle. And then it turns into the bar next door, and then it turns into, like, coming out of a blackout at 4 a.m. And usually people are mad at me. I've usually done something inappropriate, and it just spans, you know. I've said something. I've taken some action. I've just been inappropriate on so many levels. And I'm embarrassed. I also puke a lot. I almost throw up every time I drink, which is very inconvenient. You have to learn to compensate for these things. Don't throw up on yourself or in the car. It's helpful. And then I would be guilty, and I'd put together some more time, you know, a couple weeks, 7 days. On one of my last blowouts, I called someone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I called two people. One lady I didn't leave my number with by accident, so she never called me back. And then another lady I called said, if you don't get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to die. And I thought she was a lunatic and probably a little overreactive. And so I showed her. I didn't go for 7 days. And then I went to a Sunday morning speaker meeting at the Roundhouse in Richmond. And I didn't relate to anything the guy said, but for some reason I picked up a white chip. And I remember I went out to breakfast with these two older guys. I don't know, they're probably in their 70s. And I started to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous at a level that was convenient for me. So I went to meetings, like I used to go to bars. I hung out with men in the same fashion. I could not sit still in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or show up on time or stay the whole length to save my life. I would peruse the literature table during the meeting. I would go out and smoke cigarettes and then come back. I would have side conversations. I would do anything but listen and participate or be respectful. I mean, heaven forbid someone next to me might be dying of alcoholism and need to hear what's being said. And that produced me being physically without alcohol, but no effective change. I got a temporary sponsor because people were annoying me about sponsorship. I didn't do much with her. I attempted a third step and a fourth step. I don't remember doing one and two with her. I think we just talked one night after a meeting. She offered me everything she had to offer, and I'm sure if I had taken advantage of it, I would have started doing better, but I didn't. And then I got to this place where I was just, like, miserable and living in untreated alcoholism, and AA doesn't work either. I'm probably not an alcoholic. Maybe I'm mentally ill. Maybe I have X, Y, and Z going on. Maybe it's this, you know, 20-some-year-old man I'm sleeping with. I mean, who knows what's going on? He was 20-some-year-old older, you know, my sugar daddy who didn't really have any. My free ride wasn't as paved as I thought it might be. But again, it's just like I can't – everything doesn't make sense. I can't be nice to my parents even though I want to be. And I just reached this jumping off point. And my friend of mine, I used to give rides to, great guy, his name was Fritz. And he said, come with me to my home group on Friday night. And the same thing happened there that's happened many other times. I was, you know, bombarded by these women that were annoying and giving me their number as if I wanted to call them or something. Just, you know, I always feel overwhelmed with people in my space. And that happened again. But this time, when they asked me to go to the Big Book Study Weekend for the women, which sounds absolutely terrible, by the way, a whole weekend with women in the Big Book. What do you even do? That sounds terrible. I'm like, you know, Big Book weekend, alcoholic death, you know, because I'm like dramatic. I'm like praying not to wake up in the morning as I sit and smoke my cigarettes, you know. I was up to like 2 packs of cigarettes by then. Because I can't handle anything without a cigarette in my hand. And I went. And again, it was like another a crack opened up, except this one was a little bit bigger. Because what I started to see was what it means to be alcoholic. What is untreated alcoholism? What does the first step look like? Am I an alcoholic? I don't know. But it came in the shape of women who were at different times in sobriety, who were at different ages, who were, you know, people with polished toenails and their hair manicured, and people in more like me, you know, more hippie-ish, you know, or didn't have their looks all together. I was very intimidated by women. If you knew who you were or if you were in any way together, I was petrified of you. I would have just told you I didn't like women because they were backstabbing and lied and were always trying to get my man. But that's not the truth, you know. I mean, that's who I was, but that's not really what was being offered to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of that weekend, this woman approached me and she said, "Do you want to figure out if you're an alcoholic or not?" And I thought she was pretty presumptuous. She was very manicured, which I was intimidated by. And I said, "Yes, I do." And I started meeting with her every Sunday. And for a long time, it was like I would just tell her all this stuff I hadn't been telling anybody else. All these things I was so ashamed of. I was so afraid if you knew my like mental collapse before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I was going to be too screwed up for AA. And we'd read some of the Big Book. And then slowly but surely, I started to call her during the week. I started to talk to her at meetings during the week. She didn't put any label on it because I couldn't have handled that. I mean, what she did was meet me where I was and offer me the hand of AA. She offered me friendship and fellowship and an opportunity to find out the truth about myself. I believe that's one of the greatest things we can offer anyone who walks in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just sit down and help them. Maybe they don't belong here. I mean, the court system has a lot of people here. But maybe they belong somewhere else. And I feel like it's my job, if you come across my path, to help you figure that out. Because I came here a mental defect, an alcoholic, a drug addict. I mean, I had all these labels, and I just didn't know what the truth was. And I spent the next 11 years with that woman under the heading of sponsorship. And I had lots and lots and lots and lots of experiences. As I shared about earlier, I had a really hard time with unity. I had a really hard time with, like, what's this God thing? I have all this baggage from my past, you know. Is God really good? You know, when I met my husband when I was 6 months sober, I was like, you know, billboard of mental health there. I didn't want to take the third step prayer because I thought God was going to take him away from me because he's a good man. So I went home for a whole week all by myself, me and the third step. And eventually got to this place where I'm like, I don't know. And perhaps because I'm in so much mental anguish again, I'll just take the third step and see what happens. I got married to him in 2002. 2 years of sobriety, another great picture of mental health. You know, you can see 50-50 or whatever that saying is in the back. But, you know, we've been married for, 15 years now. And we've been through ups and downs. You know, we've been through 2 years sober, 3 years sober. You know, who am I? I don't know who I am. Who am I? Do you, you know, am I okay? Or do you need me to be somebody else? Because I've always defined myself through other people. And to really get, like, where my husband isn't my higher power, my sponsor isn't my higher power, my home group isn't my higher power. I mean, what does it look like to get close to this thing called, what I ended up calling God? And I have had ups and downs with God. I feel like I'm constantly too strong of a word, but I'm an exaggerator, so bear with me. That relationship for me changes a lot. I box it up, and then some holes get poked in it. And then I have this shift. I have this kind of deconstruction of what I believe and what I think and what my experience has been. And then I try to box it up again. And then that gets taken apart. I can't have kids because of the way I used to live. So, there are the haves and have-nots, and God has favorites, and we really are punished, and there really isn't forgiveness. I mean, here, take a look at that. After 5 years of infertility, I got to take a look at, I have two beautiful girls. I got to take a look at what it looks like to lose a baby. My youngest is a twin, and I lost her in my third trimester. And what does that look like, and what does that mean, and why would you do that, And I, for a long time, this is a great example of the unity I was referring to. I mean, there were things happening I didn't even know about. I mean, people in Alcoholics Anonymous carried me and my family. My family's not in AA, through really tough times in that time. And I felt safe and protected. I couldn't even zone out on TV when I was on bed rest at the end of that pregnancy because people were calling and sponsees were coming by. And, things were just happening, And then I've had experiences where even amidst that safety and protection, I'm taking God to the mat because, man, I got some questions and I want some answers, and you have failed me and I feel abandoned. And why is this so hard? Why does it feel so dark? Where are you? I mean, all that stuff has come up for me. And what I believe today is that you can take God to the mat anytime you want. My sponsor often says that to me. You rock on with that. You're not going to win, but you can do that. And I'm at a new place, now where I'm taking again, a look at what do I believe and how does that fit and how do I become a part of my community and what does it look like to have unity and be connected to people that maybe think different things than I do. I don't know. But we have a common purpose. Sounds a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous, doesn't it? And where did I learn that? Here. And so it's just another opportunity for me to practice this stuff outside, And I'm kind of running out of time here, but I want to say this piece because it's been so important in my journey. I have always, once I got this and I got on fire about it, I have always wanted to be the very best Alcoholics Anonymous member I could be. At the expense of my family, at the expense of my job, at the expense of a lot of other things. And I put that stuff in competition with each other. And I don't think that's the spiritual path. So what I've been learning over probably the past 6-ish years is what does it look like to be the best member of my family I can be and be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I can be and be, here and there and not put stuff in competition with each other. And it's scary and it's exciting and it's and I have shaved years off the life of my sponsor, I'm sure, because I have so many questions. I don't understand this. Explain this to me. But I think that's okay. I mean, all that stuff is good. And so I'm going to wrap this up here, but I would just say, even when it feels really hard, it's like, just keep doing it. The thing that has saved me is that I keep doing this. Even when it doesn't make sense, I show up, I participate. Even when I don't like you people, or when someone has hurt my feelings, or when it's inconvenient, or when it's challenging, or when I'm feel pulled in two directions, So thank you for your time and listening. Some of the greatest things we can give each other is our attention, so I appreciate it.